A few years ago, there was a sociologist by the name of Zygmunt Bauman who wrote a book called Liquid Love. And the pictures you see there on the cover features a beach with a heart drawn into the sand. But the tide is coming in, soon to wash the heart in the sand away, leaving no trace that it had ever been there. Now, the book Liquid Love is all about the relationships that we have in our modern society. On the one hand, all of us want relationships. We're wired for relationships. We want community. We all want to feel loved. We all want to feel like we belong. Perhaps more than ever, I think. Yeah, it's really interesting when you look at just the way the internet has developed. Absolutely exploded in the last decade. And not that many years ago, the internet was primarily a source of information. So you went there, you got involved online to get information. Now the internet has become a source of community. By far and away, the biggest reasons people are going online now are to connect. The big sites, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, they're all about interaction with other people. We want relationships. But on the other hand, we don't want the burden that comes with commitment. None of us want to feel trapped. We don't want our relationships to inconvenience us in any way. So we're living in this tension. We want to be close to people. We want to feel like we belong. But we want to keep our distance so that we don't feel like we're going to be imposed upon. And observing that that's the way our society is led Bauman to come up with this phrase, liquid love. It's a love that flows whenever and wherever we want it to, without ever really being pinned down in one place. Here's how he puts it. We tie bonds to other people, but they must be tied loosely so they can be untied again as quickly and as effortlessly as possible. It's liquid love. But the irony, I think, is that many people are experiencing a feeling of greater unhappiness and isolation and loneliness than ever before. So what's the answer? In Romans 12, we come to the power of true community. We looked last week, if you're here, at you remember looking at verses 1 and 2 together. And chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, are the hinge around which the book of Romans turns. Chapters 1 to 11 are largely doctrine. So in those great chapters, Paul is unpacking for us the incredible realities of what God has done, what God has made possible through the death and resurrection of his son Jesus. And Paul just unpacks this incredible long list. God has declared us not guilty. God has put us at peace with him. God has freed us from the chains of what we used to be. He's given us his spirit as a power to change us into the people we are meant to be. He's giving us assurance of never being separated from his love. And that list could go on and on and on. And I really recommend, if you weren't here, that you listen to last week and the brilliant whistle-stop tour Tim did in those chapters 1 to 11 last Sunday. But then chapter 12 begins with a massive, great therefore. And it marks the start of Paul saying, in response to this amazing kindness and grace of God, this is how you are to live. You're to offer your whole life to God, to serve him, to please him, and you are to renew your mind, verse 2, so that you can increasingly start to understand what it is that will please the God who has saved you at such great cost. Now, here's the thing about all this living sacrifices, renewing your mind stuff. When we hear that, we immediately think in individual terms. We think of it as me living to try and please God in my life. But you know what really struck me as I got to work on this passage is that the very first area Paul goes to as he unpacks what verses 1 and 2 look like in real life is the church. He goes straight to our relationship to one another because it doesn't stop with you and God. Christopher Ashe put it this way. although Christianity that does not begin with the individual does not begin, Christianity that ends with the individual ends. It's a team event. So in this little section that we're looking at this morning, Paul shows us three things that happen when we renew our minds. You get right thinking about yourself. You get the right attitude towards one another. And right serving with your gifts. So first, right thinking about yourself. It's really, really important that this all starts with your mind. It starts with your thinking. You know, in just a few verses, we're going to get to Paul describing a healthy and vibrant, living, active community. But for that to become reality, it starts with your mind, with my mind, and with your thinking. In particular, with your thinking about yourself. Look at verse 3. For by the grace given to me, I say to every one of you, do not think of yourself more highly than you ought. Now right there, straight away, we're into very countercultural waters. It seems to me one of the big messages of our time is the message of high self-esteem. So to be happy, to be fulfilled, to be content, you need to stop worrying about what other people think of you. You need to stop judging yourself by other people's opinions of you. Stop letting yourself be controlled by what others think of you. And that's really good advice. The problem is where our culture goes with that advice. Because where it goes next is to say, look, the only thing that should concern you is what you think of you. Yet don't let other people rule your life. Be who you are. It's about living up to your standards. That's the advice of our culture. Low self-esteem is a really, really bad thing. And the way we solve it is high self-esteem. You just need to realize how great you are. You just need to realize how wonderful you are. But here's the problem with that. Well, here's one of the problems with that. When your life is lived by that approach, you inevitably become proud and competitive. Because the way that you will try to keep up this high self-esteem is by assuring yourself that you are better than everyone else. That's the only way you'll be able to keep feeling secure about yourself, is to tell yourself, I'm better than others. There's a really, really great bit in Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis where he talks about pride. And he talks about how innately competitive pride is. Listen to what he says. Pride gets no pleasure out of having something, but only out of having more of it than the next person. We say that people are proud of being rich or clever or good-looking, but they are not. They are proud of being richer or cleverer, or better looking than others. If everyone else were to become equally rich or clever or good looking, there would be nothing to be proud about. Can you see how pride, how thinking of yourself more highly than you ought, is incredibly destructive to real community? Because at its heart, it's competitive. If I'm needing to live with high self-esteem as what keeps me going, I need to know that I'm better than you. And for you to keep your self-esteem high, you need to know that you're better than me. And so inwardly in our hearts, or even outwardly in our behavior, we compete. We need to be better than each other. We need to outdo one another, and it ruins community. So what's the alternative? Because it might sound like the Christian mindset is a whole lot worse. That it's all about having really low self-esteem. Let's all constantly be really down on ourselves and just be a really glum bunch of people. But that's not at all what Paul is suggesting here. The answer is found in the second half of verse 3. Do not think of yourself more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment. Literally, Paul says, think of yourself with a sound mind, in accordance with the measure of faith God has given you. Now, there's some debate knocking around about how that phrase should be understood. And it all depends on the meaning of the word measure in that verse. Because the word measure can either mean a quantity or a standard. If it means the quantity of faith God has given, then it kind of gives us this picture that God has got a massive big vat of faith, and he goes around with a giant ladle, and he sort of dishes out a portion of faith to each of us in different ways, different quantities. In context, I don't think that would make sense. But there's another way that the word measure is often used in the New Testament. And that's to mean a standard by which we measure something. So one obvious example that I guess we all relate to. In October, we know that we're going to put the clocks back. Yeah? Sometime in October. We will all change our clocks back an hour. And we will align them. We will set them to the measure or the standard of Greenwich Mean Time. If Paul is using the word measure in that way, he's saying we're to set our thinking about ourselves according to the measure or the standard of faith. And that is something that is radically different from both low self-esteem and high self-esteem. It's not something in the middle, it's something altogether different. Let me explain. Back in the very early chapters of Romans, Paul built for us this case that every single one of us in humanity is guilty before God. We've all fallen short of God's mark. We've all worshipped things in the creation and not the creator. And Paul says that's left all of us deserving the condemnation of God. But then after a few chapters of the bad news, Paul hits us with the cross of Jesus. The incredible news that in dying for us, Jesus receives the punishment that our guilty verdict deserves, so that God can give us the innocent verdict that we do not deserve. But here's the point. The very next thing Paul says when he's got to the cross is this: where then is boasting? How can you boast when somebody else is 100% responsible for where you stand before God? So here's what I want you to see. When you think of yourself against or in accordance with the standard of faith, that you are only saved by God's grace through faith, that will make you a person neither of low self-esteem nor of high self-esteem. Why not? Well, you won't be able to have low self-esteem. Because the God of the universe loved you so infinitely much that he came up with a plan. And it was a plan so radical and so costly and so inconceivable that it meant him sending his only Son, God the Son, the second person of the Trinity, to die as a man on a cross. The creator of the world did that for you, and he did it because he wanted to rescue you. How does that fit with low self-esteem? Could you be more valued? Could you be more affirmed? Could you be more accepted? The lens of the gospel means you cannot have low self-esteem. And yet, you also won't be able to have prideful high self-esteem, because you will know all of that is undeserved. You will know I am utterly dependent on the grace of God. You will know I am but a sinner who has flung myself at the foot of the cross for the mercy of God. Nothing in my hand I bring. Simply to thy cross I cling. Tim Keller once described it brilliantly, and I've never been able to find it since, but it was something like this. The cross humbles you into the dust because Jesus had to die for you. Such was your sin. But the cross affirms you to the skies that Jesus was glad to die for you. Such was his love. That is right thinking about yourself. And when that is how you begin to view yourself, only then can we move towards true community. Because that kind of thinking frees you from being plagued by the insecurities that stem from needing to gain approval. You won't anymore be gripped by this need to outdo one another, to be better than one another. because you will know you are loved and accepted and approved and secure in the gospel of Jesus. And nor will you be able to think too highly of yourself, because you will say every day, I know I'm a wretched sinner, deserving nothing but the wrath of God. It is only by grace. So what grounds do I possibly have for boasting or arrogance or competition or pride? So if we are to be a community that really works, it starts in the mind. It starts in your thinking, in thinking of yourself with gospel thinking. And only then can we move to having the right attitude to one another. I hope you forgive me for inflicting yet one more Olympic illustration on you. But one of the things that really struck me as the Olympics and subsequently the Paralympics has been going on was this sense of national spirit that sprung up. I guess you felt that too, many of you. Even before it began, you know, when the torch was coming through and people come out of their homes and actually talk to people that they don't know and all those really, you know, terrifying things. It was like we all felt part of something. We were Team GB for just those few precious weeks. Even some of you Americans were trying to get on board and adopt us as your own. And I think that was evidence, that spirit that sprung up, it was evidence of how deep down we all instinctively want to belong. Well, what Paul says next is incredible. He says that when you come to Jesus, when you put your faith in Jesus, you automatically become joined to the most profoundly and deeply connected community. A community so interconnected, so interdependent, that the best metaphor Paul can find for it, both here and elsewhere, is the human body itself. Look at verses 4 and 5. Just as each of us has one body with many members, and these members do not all have the same function, so in Christ, we who are many form one body, and each member belongs to all the others. Now, as I was thinking about this one body, many parts metaphor, as we often call it, I think that we very naturally love the many parts bit. That bit resonates very easily with us, this idea that we're all different, this idea that we're to celebrate and embrace our diversity. Yeah, we're all unique. We all have our own gifts and abilities. Yeah, we like that bit. For our culture, it's the one body bit that really, really gets us. Like some of you, I grew up watching Friends. What a great show. The opening credits of Friends would roll, and Ross and Rachel and Chandler and Joey and Monica and Phoebe would dance around in the fountain. And the theme song would play. I'm not going to sing it. You know, I'll be there for you because you're there for me too. Now, I can see some of you welling up with nostalgia right now. And some of you thinking, what on earth is this Friends thing? I've never seen that. Don't worry. Get the box set. As that beginning played, for the generation that grew up with it, we loved that. We were drawn in by the idea. You know, we wanted to be part of that group as we saw them dancing together and getting soaked in the fountain and everyone singing, you know, I'm there for you, you're there for me too. We love that. It's so appealing. But in reality, we want it on our terms. Bauman describes it brilliantly in Liquid Love when he says we have conflicting desires to tighten the bonds, yet keep them loose. That's the paradox. We want to tighten the bonds. We want to feel like we belong. And yet we want to keep them loose. We want the community without the commitment. We want the intimacy without the inconvenience. But it doesn't work. True commitment is only found in the context of a radical interdependency, in being one body. And I really want to press the force to you of the bit Paul says at the end of verse 5, which is so radical. Did it hit you when I read it just now? Each member belongs to all the others. Let that sink in. Take a look around you. You belong to each other. Now we're thinking, whoa, hang on a minute, you know, this is outrageously countercultural. I just came for a nice morning at church. Because we're used to it being about me, aren't we? We're used to a society where it is all about my needs, my freedoms, my rights, my pleasure, my preferences. But the church of Jesus couldn't be any more different. Do you realize what this means? It means you are not primarily here for your benefit. You are not part of this church primarily for your own benefit. That might be a complete mindset shift. But you belong to one another, says Paul. We belong for one another, for each other's good. Let me throw out a few ways I think this applies to us. They're just a few starters, really. First, and maybe most basic, I think it means that wherever possible, we are to be here. That might sound really obvious, but it's worth saying. The writer to the Hebrews said, "Do not give up meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing, but encourage each other all the more as you see the day of Christ approaching." You know, if we were part of church primarily for our own benefit, it wouldn't be such a big deal if we took it or left it sometimes, because only you would miss out by not being here. But you're not. We belong to each other. So when you're not here, the body is missing a part. It's like a human body walking down the street with an eye missing, or with an arm missing, or with a big toe on your left foot missing. Whatever part you want to think of yourself as, pick a nice one. But we need each other. We need each other. Secondly, I think it means we need to intentionally resist and fight the consumer attitudes of our hearts. Do you realize how much of a consumer you are? We very, very easily approach church as a consumer. So we come to receive a service. We come to receive a product. And it's about my checklist. So I expect to be impressed and engaged and inspired by the sermon. No comments, please. I expect to be part of music that is to my tastes. I expect a midweek program that ticks all my boxes. I expect a dynamic kids' work, efficient pastoral care. The list goes on and on and on. Now, please don't get me wrong. It's not that many of those things are not important. But where is this renewed mindset that we belong to one another? It's not about getting the product you want. And if you don't like it, you go and get a different brand down the road. It's about being bound together in the body of Jesus Christ for the mission and glory of God. That's what it's about. And here's where I think it gets really radical, because surely if belonging to one another means anything, it means that our time, our gifts, our money, even our homes belong to one another. How about that for radical? I read a blog post just a few weeks ago about a book called The Secret Thoughts of an Unlikely Convert by a lady called Rosaria Butterfield. But that's by the by, really. In the book, she describes the open door policy of her house in their home. And here's what she says. "Anything worth doing will take time and cost you something. We noticed, as our attention focused more on families and children, that many people in our community protect themselves from inconvenience as though inconvenience is deadly. We decided that we are not inconvenienced by inconvenience. We are sure that the Good Samaritan had other plans that fateful day." I love that. "We are sure that the Good Samaritan had other plans that fateful day." You know, that last but one sentence really challenges me. If you want to go out of here today applying Romans 12 to your attitude to one another, here's a good place to start. Decide that you are not inconvenienced by inconvenience. Unless we decide that, we will be, won't we? We know what we're like. We love our plans to be just as we want them to be. We love our homes to be our castles. People come across the threshold only on our terms. We put boxes and guards and protection around everything as though inconvenience is the deadly disease of all. Don't we need some renewing of our minds? So in Christ, we who are many form one body, and each member belongs to all the others. How are you displaying that reality in your life? With your time, with your money, with your home, with your resources. Let me put it this way, where are you being inconvenienced for the sake of the body to which you belong? It's scary stuff, isn't it, in such an individualistic age, but this is true community. This is real church. It's the unity that, as we saw in John 17, shows the world Jesus is real. Because it's concrete love, not liquid love. Now, as we end this section, we now see that because we belong to one another, we must therefore serve one another. So lastly, the renewed mind results in right serving with your gifts. Look at verse 6. We have different gifts according to the grace given us. Now, some of you need to hear that again and again and again. That verse means a few things. It means that if you're a Christian, you have been given a gift, a spiritual gift. You have one, at least one. It also means that you have the one that you're meant to have. You are who you were meant to be. It wouldn't work if you were anybody else. 1 Corinthians 12, Paul says, God has arranged the parts just as he meant for them to be. That is such a great truth. You are meant to be who you are. And that verse also reminds us that whatever your gift is, it is a gift. So you've got no right to boast. None of our gifts are earned. So there's no place for you feeling superior to anybody else, nor is there a place for you to feel inferior to anybody else. Some of us need our minds renewed on that. And then Paul gives us a list. It's far from exhaustive, but here they are. If a man's gift is prophesying, let him use it in proportion to his faith. The translation is not super helpful here. In the Greek, there is no his. So what it really says is, let him use it in accordance with the faith, as the footnotes got it, or in agreement with the faith. In other words, if somebody's gift is speaking the word of God, they are to do so in a way that means they only say things that fit with the faith. They are to be true to the message. If it is serving, let him serve or her serve. Mary was right to say this applies to women too. If it is teaching, let him teach. If it is encouraging, let him encourage. If it is contributing to the needs of others, let him give generously. And why? Because our resources are not our own. We belong to one another. If it is leadership, let him govern diligently. If it is showing mercy, let him do it cheerfully. You know, the big thrust of all that, I think, is really straightforward. We are here to serve. Every last one of us. We're not here to serve ourselves. There are lots of ways that we can serve that are really to serve ourselves. To gain influence in the church, to wield power in the church, to get to know more than anyone else about what's getting on or going on in church life, to get recognition, to get praise. It's not about those things. Paul says God has given you a gift. And the reason he's given you a gift is so that you will use it with all the passion and energy and enthusiasm that you can. To serve and meet the needs of the body to which you belong. Is that what you're doing? Graham Bynum's written a great little book called God's New Community, and he gives this illustration in the book. Imagine you get a work party together to do some DIY. You walk around at the start and you give some people paintbrushes, some screwdrivers, others hammers, and so on. And then you say, whatever tool you've got, get on and use it. Paul's cry here is like that. If your gift is serving, get serving. If your gift is encouraging, get encouraging. The church is like a ship where the only people on board are the crew, and they all have a job to do. Get using your gifts. Now, maybe you feel like you're unsure about what they are. Maybe you're unsure about where the opportunity is for you to get serving. So I'm going to ask you to do something really practical this morning. Before you leave today, will you speak to one of the team? Arrange to meet with us to talk it through, to help you get serving. to using the gift that you've been given for the sake of the body. That's one thing you could do. Another thing you could do is take in one of these leg challenge forms that Mark's done. I can't even remember why they're called legs challenge, but anyway. Yellow forms, they're in the foyer. I'll grab a bundle of them and have them with me. You can take one on the way out. It's got a whole list of areas of church life, ministries, areas of service. Fill that in. Put down the things that you like to do. And we'll follow it up with you. Where are your passions? But get serving. Get on board. God has placed a tool in your hand. Are you using it? Now, as I wrap up, I want to end by mentioning a couple of things that Tim has said this past week. I've checked with him, I can do this, so it's okay. The first is something that Tim said to us on Tuesday night at our pastors and deacons meeting. Tim said to us that when you're part of a slightly larger church by, I guess, UK standards, you can get comfortable. You can get content. And you can forget that even if this room right now were to be full to overflowing, it would be but a tiny percentage of the population that is out there. There are many, 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 many thousands of people who are out there getting on with life with no knowledge whatsoever of the Jesus who alone can save them. So that means we must resist getting content with 250, 300 people, whatever we get in here on a Sunday morning. You know, this church thing is not about just holding services. It's not just about having a nice midweek program and keeping everything ticking along nicely. It's about God rescuing sinners from a lost path to judgment that they're facing for a life of hope and purpose and meaning and a future of an eternal life that is life restored as it was meant to be. That's our mission. So God has given us gifts. They're to serve one another, yes. But they're to serve with one another in this mission of sharing good news, the only news that will save the thousands of people. There's people walking past right now that I can see. And what are they doing? They're shopping. They're getting on with life. And they're doing it without Jesus. And that leads to the second thing, which was the illustration Tim gave last Sunday morning about when Steve Jobs was persuading John Sculley to move from being chief exec of Pepsi to come and join Apple. And he did so with that famous line, the legendary line, "Do you want to sell sugared water for the rest of your life, or do you want to come with me and change the world?" Apple have changed the world to a degree, but they're not really going to change the world. And I'm preaching this off an iPad, okay? So for me to say that, that's a big deal. But, you know, the Church of Jesus Christ is the community that God has designed to be the one that changes the world. Do you realize that? We are how God is going to change the world. Because when we get a right view of ourselves and therefore get rid of the pride and the competition that ruins and divides us, and then when we start to see ourselves as belonging to one another and start allowing ourselves to be inconvenienced a little bit more, and when we start using the powerful gifts God has entrusted to us for the sake of one another and for the sake of our joint mission together, when that happens, we change the world. One person at a time, one salvation at a time. Do you want to come with me and change the world? Not to make electronic devices, but to change people's eternities. We can, through the power of true community.